Our true crime podcast deals with sensitive issues, including some that little ears shouldn't hear. Listener discretion is advised.
This is Cam.
And I'm Jen.
And you're listening to
Our True Crime Podcast.
Good morning. This is your faithful horror host, Edward October. Tune in to Octoberpod Home Video on YouTube, where each month we tell a new spooky story. What is Octoberpod, you ask? Octoberpod is the creepy urban legend told to you by a friend over a bottle of wine. Octoberpod is the long, restless night you spent in the basement, waiting for the storm to pass. Still curious? Subscribe to Octoberpod Home Video on YouTube, or follow me on Twitter, at OctoberpodVHS. Octoberpod, the place where nightmare and nostalgia coexist.
This is Brew Crime, a craft beer and true crime podcast. I'm Mike.
And I am Beck, and we are your hosts.
On Brew Crime, we each take a true crime story and we pair it with a craft beer.
You can find our show on your favorite podcast apps. If you can't find it, contact us and we'll try to change that.
We can be found at www.brewcrime.com or on Twitter at @brewcrime, and also on all the social media platforms for Pacific Beer Chat at Pacific Beer Chat. We can also be found at brewcrime@pacificbeerchat.com.
Join us as we discuss depraved killers, stupid criminals, and likely some completely unrelated tangents.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks.
You showered for me?
Yeah, sure.
Fine. Mm-hmm. You need to shower again, I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, it's been a little hectic here in my little household, so.
Okay, so what's going on? What you got?
Hey, I've got some shout-outs.
Woohoo, let's do it.
We got some good shout-outs here. We got some shout-outs on Twitter.
I love me the Twitter.
We do. We've got some new friends on the Twitter. Leslie.
Hi, Leslie.
Jer.
Oh, Jer Bear. Hi, Jer Bear.
And not your mom friend. Thanks for reaching out to us. We love you.
One of us loves you more than the other because she's weird.
The other one's just cold. When she puts a ice cube in her mouth, it gets bigger. It doesn't dissolve. No. Then we got some reviews on our iTunes. So big, huge thank you to Linda Elizabeth.
Yay!
Kiki the Creator or Kai Kai the Creator.
Yay!
Not really sure which. And Crime Junkie Gal.
Oh, that's so cute. I love it. I do love it.
And then Facebook. We got two reviews on Facebook, which is awesome. There's Mary and Audra.
Mary and Audra. Thank you, ladies.
We love you.
Hi,
all.
Audra. Thank you.
Thank you for being our friends.
Yes. Awesome.
We dig it the most.
The mostest.
The mostest. What you got for us today?
Oh, I tell you, Jen. Yesterday, I wrote two scripts in a day. I wouldn't recommend that because it was crossing over.
Yeah.
And it was a little confusing. And then at the end of the day, I was drained.
Yeah.
That's a lot of mayhem to absorb.
Oh, I know.
Right?
I worked on one, got 10 pages in, and I'm not even half of the story yet.
Yeah. Maybe that could be a series.
Like, it could be. It's pretty long.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's what she said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's two dumb jokes right at the top. We're done, both of us.
Well, you're usually at the bottom, so it kind of works out.
I hate you. So anyway.
What you got?
I have a case about somebody that preyed on co-eds. Now, we are all familiar with the co-ed killer, which is?
It's too early. It really is.
Ed Kemper.
Oh.
I screamed that. Sorry. Ed Kemper.
Ed Kemper, yes.
This is not that co-ed killer. This is a different one.
Ed Kemper, the one that read audiobooks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
For the blind.
Mm-hmm.
Which is weird.
Well, good for him.
Question mark?
Good for the blind? Better than making license plates.
I guess that's true. All right, you ready?
I'm ready. Hit me. Well, don't hit me. Tell it to me.
I'll hit you, all right.
Sock it to me, Camille.
I said we're done with the dumb jokes.
Okay. You're a dumb joke.
Your mom's a dumb joke.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, sorry.
Not really, Mom, but Camille really means it.
No, that's not. Come on now. All right. So it was August 7th, 1967, and two boys from Superior Township were out getting ready to work in a field near an old farmhouse. The boys heard a car approaching the area, then heard a car door open and slam before speeding away. Naturally, the boys went to investigate, and what they found would terrify this Michigan college town, but it was only the beginning, as this phantom killer would continue working for 2 years.
Wow. Did they find an empty keg? College town?
I get it. I told you we're done with the dumb jokes.
Oh, sorry.
All right, so today we're all familiar with Ted Bundy, who stalked and murdered the cute college co-eds in the state of Washington, right? However, this monster was operating 7 years before Ted even started.
Oh, wow.
Forensic psychology, all that, we're going to get into that because this was all prior to all that coming about. The murderer would take seven young women from Ypsilanti, Michigan, home of Eastern Michigan University.
Go Eagles!
And would eventually earn the moniker the Michigan Murderer and the Coed Killer.
So is this the original Coed Killer?
He was operating about the same time as Ed was, but Ed, this was more the Ted Bundy style. This is what he did. Like, okay. He would pick up women and, you know.
Yeah, charm them.
This case has a lot of names in it, so I'm sure I will mispronounce some.
I'm sure, too.
Thanks, Jen. Well, I'm going to try hard.
It's hard.
It is hard. So
it's so hard.
In July of 1967, 19-year-old Mary Fizer left her apartment on campus to go for a walk and simply vanished. Her roommate alerted her parents and the police. As is usually the case, authorities thought that maybe Mary just needed a break from the stress of school and would return soon. The parents told police that Mary was not the kind to just drop out and do that. So police started hitting the area, right?
Right.
They're canvassing the area. About a half an hour into doing this, a campus police officer said he had spotted the girl walking alone. So that was, you know,
right.
She did take a walk. Right after that, a man who was sitting outside gave authorities a lead. He had told them that he saw her walking and that a young man driving a bluish-gray Chevy stopped beside her, opened his window, and talked to her. He noted that Mary shook her head as if to say no. The car then drove away, but pulled up again in front of her. She again shook her head and walked around him. He backed out, accelerated very angrily, he said, and screeched away. Concerned, the man on the porch actually continued to watch her till she got close to her building, and then he lost sight of her, but he never saw the car return. Now, it would turn out that this man was the last person to see Mary alive.
Oh, wow. Good for him.
So two boys, now these were the boys I opened the story with, two boys named Russell Crisovan Jr., age 15, and Mark Lewis, age 15, were working at the farm preparing to plow a field when they heard the car door slam. By the time they reached the area, the car was long gone, but the boys did notice fresh tire marks in the weeds and followed them for about 20 feet. As they were walking in these tracks, the boys could smell an awful stench in the air. They could see an object on the ground, and at first, they thought it was a rotting deer. Since it was summer, the flies and the bugs were buzzing about all above whatever it was. As they got closer, they noticed that the deer appeared to have a head, but what they could clearly see was a human ear. And so the boys ran out of there and went straight to the Michigan State Police.
So she had been missing about 30 days, right?
Yeah.
Before the boys found her?
Yes. She disappeared July and wasn't discovered till August 7th.
Oh my gosh.
So as police investigated the scene, clothing found near the body was identified as belonging to Mary. The postmortem on her remains showed that she had been stabbed in a frenzied attack about 30 or 40 times. And her hands and feet had been removed.
Oh, no.
Detectives who examined the crime scene said the body had been moved at least three times, possibly by animals or possibly by the killer, who apparently had returned at least once.
No.
What they had determined.
Not to just visit the body, correct?
I don't want to know.
No.
The body was first placed on top of a pile of bottles and cans in an area obscured by a clump of box elder trees. It was moved about 5 feet south and possibly stayed there for quite some time. Later, the body was moved 3 feet away from that area and then again moved once more. So somebody obviously was coming out there.
It had to have been a person. If it was an animal, there would have been.
Yeah, it's heavy.
If it was an animal, there would have been marks
that
animals leave. Oh, what a sick.
Oh, just wait. You ready for this one?
I'm surprised I haven't heard this.
All right.
Or maybe I'm in just my
bubble.
Dayquil's.
I like you in your Dayquil state.
Yeah.
So here we go. You ready? Mm-hmm. And from the book of Super Freak Weirdo.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry.
The one you wrote? Huh?
Yeah, that's one I wrote. It was you 2 days.
It. That's what I love it. You own that Super Freak title.
Yeah. Fly that freak flag high, girl.
Exactly.
Anyway, back to me. So anyway.
We were talking about you.
I know. I hate you. So just 2 days later, okay, mm-hmm. after she was discovered, her body turned over to authorities and all that stuff, the staff of the Moore Funeral Home was, you know, shocked when a good-looking man came in inside the funeral home where Mary's body was being prepared for the service and the burial with a bizarre request. The man told the employees he was a close family friend of the Pfizers and asked if he could take a photograph of Mary's body.
No.
Seems he wanted a keepsake to remember her by. Nope.
Was this after
this was 2 days?
Prepared it?
Yes. So she had been 2 days after she was
they
found.
Said no, correct?
When he was told that that was impossible, he shrugged and left. The receptionist noticed that he was driving a blue-gray Chevrolet. Only after he left did employees realize that he did not have a camera. And you got to remember this 1967, so there was no digital or none of that small stuff. Cameras were pretty large.
Well, I just want to say something here. This is the third, and I'll have the fourth case where the murderer will be driving some kind of blue-gray Chevy vehicle. I'm just saying.
Hmm.
So girls, don't get date in the car anybody with a blue-gray Chevy.
Good point.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, nobody at the funeral home, I think they were so shocked by this.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't get his name, but they didn't even really get, they were kind of just shocked, okay?
That would be so disarming to have somebody come in and say, yeah,
they actually, I mean, he asked for them to open the casket so he could, who does that? Nearly a year had passed when, on July 6th, 1968, 20-year-old student named Joan Schnell was abducted. The disappearance had some striking similarities to that of Mary's. Joan had just moved into a house on Emmett Street and was last seen getting into a car with three boys. One of them was wearing an EMU shirt.
Go Eagles!
Jane was found 5 days later, raped and stabbed an estimated 47 times.
No!
Strangely, it was noted she had been dead for days, but the body had only lay where it was discovered for less than 24 hours. Cops learned she was last seen with a fellow student, one John Norman Collins, on July 1st. Collins was a failing student at EMU.
Go Eagles!
Who had recently been evicted from the Theta Chi fraternity. Collins was living directly across the street from her house on Emmett. Collins was immediately questioned and claimed he was with his mama at her house in Cedar Line, Michigan. Now, that's just north of the Detroit border at the time. Police took him for his word without verifying this because, well, you know, he was personable, cute, handsome, well-liked.
Oh, yeah.
You know the type. Ted Bundy, right? 8 months passed when in March 1969, the lifeless body of Jane Mixer was discovered just a few miles outside of Ypsilanti. She had been shot and strangled. Her shoes and a copy of Joseph Heller's novel, Catch-22, were placed by her side.
Huh.
You may notice this method of murder is a little different than the ones before her, and there's a reason for that. But we'll backtrack at the end here.
Okay.
So obviously, this butcher is getting good at what he's doing, and he's liking it, right? So naturally, like they all do, he starts picking up the pace.
Right.
So March 26th.
Well, the kill's not becoming as satisfying anymore for as long as of time.
The cooling period is not as long.
Right.
Right. He needs to get that thrill. So March 26, 1969, construction workers working near Schnell's murder site discovered another body. 16-year-old Marilyn Skelton was thoroughly bludgeoned to death.
Mm.
A stick had been savagely rammed into her vagina. And there was evidence that she had been flogged with a heavy strap, such as a large buckled belt, before she died. So her body was covered with welts. Her clothes, except her underwear, were piled beside her body, her shoes next to her feet, and a piece of dark blue cloth was stuffed into her throat. Since she was a known drug abuser, police felt that they that maybe she was running with the wrong crowd and had ended up murdered.
Yeah, that's all it is.
She had been hitchhiking the day she disappeared.
So he kept the underwear as a souvenir, I guess.
You'll have to wait and see, Jen.
Lord have mercy.
So just 3 short weeks later, this is how fast this is going, 13-year-old Dawn Bossom was found half naked and strangled to death with an electrical cord. She was slashed up. Mm. Her breasts were slashed, her face, her buttocks. Police began to scour the area and they come to an abandoned farmhouse. And you'll notice this farmhouse keeps reoccurring. Inside, they locate the sweater she was wearing, along with an electrical cord similar to the one they found with her body. Now, Dawn would be this killer's youngest victim.
Oh, 13.
13, she's a baby. So it was at this time the killer started to taunt police. Officers returned to search the farmhouse. This is so strange. A second time, making sure they didn't overlook anything. To their shock, they found clothes that had previously not been in the farmhouse. A short time after this peculiar discovery, someone lit the farmhouse on fire. When police arrived on scene, lined up along the driveway as if, you know, welcoming them to the scene, were 5 clipped lilac blossoms, one for each victim that he had murdered.
Wow.
Is he something else or what?
Mm-hmm.
The 6th victim was named Allison Kalam, age 23. 3 boys were walking across a field at a farm on June 8th when they stumbled upon Allison. Allison was stabbed multiple times and her throat was cut, as well as being shot in the head. Her clothes were tossed about her. A sheer purple strip cut from her blouse was tied around her forehead. Her pantyhose were slashed at the crotch, and one of her purple shoes were missing. She was last seen leaving a party in Ann Arbor the day before.
You know, sidetrack here for just a second. I wonder about all these boys or kids that stumble across these bodies and how it affects them for the rest of their lives.
That would actually be interesting to look up and see.
Yeah.
Because I think that would be horrible.
I mean, especially at what? How old were these kids?
Young. That dog I found at the end of my street horrified me. I still think about that thing.
I know.
It's terrible.
It would... I couldn't.
Police found that the murder site was 5 miles from where the body was found. It was at this location that officers found a pair of brown loafers and 2 red buttons missing from the victim's raincoat, along with brownish stains scattered all over, which did turn out to be blood. And they matched the victim's type. So
yeah,
that's how they,
DNA,
they could see that the bodies were being moved. The loafers fit. Now, this was kind of weird. She's got, so you think about it, 2 pairs of shoes, but there's a reason. The loafers fit the victim's feet, and the purple shoes were soon explained because it was discovered she had just bought them. An empty shoebox lay in her apartment along with her purse, indicating that the killer may have been inside her place with her, and then they left the place, or he killed her in there, and then...
The purple shoes? She had just bought the purple shoes?
She just bought those.
Mm-hmm.
And he may, in fact, have the other purple shoe. So only one purple shoe was found. But she did buy new purple shoes, so one was missing.
Wow. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. He's taking more souvenirs.
Yeah. So police, this is kind of cool. Police rented a vacant seminary where they would all come together and discuss the crime and share evidence. And at this point, you know, there was a lot of other police departments that were lending a hand in this.
Right. As they should.
Right. However, also at this time, a citizens group, outraged by the failures of the multiple police departments, decided to take action.
Oh, that always... ends well.
They raised money and contacted the famous psychic.
Debbie Dorfman from John David Booter's Done Disappeared. Right?
No.
She's fantastic. No?
No. It was psychic Peter Hurkos.
Who?
Exactly.
Debbie Dorfman would have had this figured
Debbie
out.
Debbie Dorfman, this, it would have ended right now.
She is the most amazing psychic.
She really is. She knows what's up.
I don't even know if she was born by then, but she could have told us.
She could have been. Because you know what? Psychic, she would have just put her energy through somebody else.
Right.
Like Peter Hurkos.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Did she's...
No, he did not do well.
Oh, then Debbie did.
Yeah, he was kind of famous for being involved in the Boston Strangler case a few years earlier. And, you know, some stuff he kind of gave them that was pretty good. Some of it was misleading.
On the Collins case? On this case?
Yes, on this case. Such as he predicted that the killer would strike again.
Oh, wow.
Debbie Dorfman would have had that. Case would have been solved. Bada bing, bada bam, boom. And of course, he was right.
Right.
He did strike again. Karen Sue Bindeman, age 18, would become this killer's last victim.
Mm.
Karen, who had written to her parents that she was being very careful, accepted a ride with the stranger, okay? And you got to imagine, at 18, it's probably your first year in college, they're all worried. Well, she accepted a ride from a stranger to come home. The stranger was on a motorcycle, and it was July 23rd, 1969. So, Karen?
It's a motorcycle. They're dangerous.
Yeah, but a cute boy on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Okay. Young girl, you know. The good part about this is that this would be the killer's tragic downfall. Thank right. goodness, mm-hmm. because he messed up. Well, he messed up a couple times, but this is a good one. So Karen had went to an area wig shop. Okay. She's only 18. And while she was in the shop, she mentioned to the owner, quote, "I'm either the bravest or the dumbest girl ever because I just accepted a ride from a stranger on a motorcycle," end quote.
Wow.
Now, being the mom that we are, that
we'd scold her and say, "What the hell are you doing?"
The owner of the wig shop warned Karen to not go with the man. But of course, as teens do,
they don't care.
They dismiss the advice. You don't know what you're talking
about.
They're
smarter than...
You're grown up.
When you're a teen? When you're an old teen? Oh, yeah.
So 3 days later, sadly, she was found strangled, beaten, and sexually abused. She had been raped either while she was dying or right afterwards. Once one side of her face was covered in bruises, so he obviously beat her. The autopsy later revealed that a piece of material was stuffed into her throat. Yep. Her torn panties were stuffed into her vagina. And here's the other mistake he made. There were human hair clippings stuck to her panties. Not pubic hair, but like freshly cut hair. She had been in that location only about a day and a half. The owner of the store was able to clearly give police a good description of the boy on the bike.
Yay. See something, say something. Hero. I'm holding out for a hero to the end of the night.
And he's gotta be strong. And
she's gotta own a wood shop at night. Right? Is that how that goes?
Yes, that's exactly how it goes.
Good for her. Yay.
So now the police are going to get a little creative. Not that this is funny, because this is totally not funny. But if you and I were on a police force, this is what would happen to us.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So after the murder, Sheriff Doug Harvey came up with a plan. Mm-hmm. Harvey ordered a news blackout. You know what that is, right?
Right.
That's where the news media can't report anything. So he managed to keep the discovery of Karen out of the news and swore the boys who had found her to secrecy. Now, earlier I had mentioned that it was believed that the killer was coming back to visit and admire his work and do whatever else. Ugh. They decided it might be an opportunity to trap him. So police go to the local JCPenney store and borrow a what?
Mannequin.
They remove the body of Karen and they position the mannequin in the same location Karen was found, all while police take position all around the area and they were quietly watching. You think this is going to go to plan?
Probably not.
Because I said this would happen to you and I.
Right.
So the plan didn't quite go as planned.
Huh.
It was rainy. It was hard to see. Now, when a deputy spotted a man stopping by the mannequin, he was out for a jog. Mm-hmm. At midnight, mind
well, then,
you.
Yeah.
The officer tried to radio a description to the others, but his walkie-talkie failed.
Mm-hmm.
The sound of the car engine told him that whoever it was, the midnight jogger, he just jogged back to his car and got in there. So he knew that they were there. And again, he slipped away.
So it was the killer and he was pretending to jog.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was midnight and you're in a car. Like,
I didn't know that he was in a car at first.
Well, you don't, but like they heard him leave.
Okay. Gotcha. Because I was going to say, it would just, you know, joggers always find the body, right?
Totally.
That's why I don't jog. Got in his car and drove away. That's my kind of jogging, in the car.
The police had to go back to what, you know, they had to kind of start over. So
right.
They went back to the wig shop, and between three witnesses, they were able to get a good composite sketch, okay? One of the people was adamant that the man had been riding a Triumph motorcycle.
Oh, yeah.
Triumph's a brand, Jen. I know you probably don't know that, but it's a brand.
Well, we are sitting in a room full of Hot Wheels and Matchbox cars along with my motorcycles.
Okay.
I do know what a Triumph is.
Point taken.
Mm-hmm. I could even point one out for you.
So as this case has so many twists and turns, here's another one where somebody's trying to be good. They're trying to lend a hand, but sometimes it's just not the way it should go.
Right.
During this time, a young campus policeman named Larry Matheson was putting together a profile. He was on it. He was going to get this
guy. Good for
him. Right? So he knew the aforementioned person, John Norman Collins, that I had brought up earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you remember he was questioned during the second murder investigation.
Right. But he was too cute and charming.
Uh-huh.
And there's no way he could be a killer.
Yes. However, this campus policeman had remembered seeing Collins cruising around that day. So he borrowed a photo from a former girlfriend of Collins and asked around campus. He took it to a girl who noticed the make of the motorcycle. She readily identified him. This campus policeman decided to start investigating Collins. So as the campus officer wasn't experienced with murders, right?
Obviously. No training whatsoever.
He decided to pay a visit, unscheduled, to Collins.
Oh, good.
So what does this do with Collins?
It scares him off.
Gives him a heads up, right? He knows something's up. So Collins has the opportunity to hide any evidence he had had in his possession.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interesting to note, Collins' housemate at the time, Arnold Davis, recalled that he had taken a box covered with a blanket out of his room. So as Davis opened the door for him, he spotted something. Do you know what it was?
A purple shoe?
A woman's purple shoe.
Ah, look at me.
Rolled up jeans and a handbag inside the box. Collins later returned without the box and said he had, quote, gotten rid of it. He was put under surveillance, but no one could stop him from thoroughly cleaning out his car.
Right.
Right.
Wow.
So bless the little policeman that tried to help the college guy, but he kind of messed that up a little bit.
He did, just a bit.
It's okay. His heart was in the right place.
Yeah.
So here's where things get a little interesting.
Okay. Well, a little interesting.
Well, more,
the whole thing's been interesting.
More interesting. Okay. So at the same time all this was going on, Police Corporal David Leake returned home from vacation with his wife and three young sons. His nephew was watching the house while they were gone.
Huh.
Upon returning, Leake's wife noticed patches of black paint on the concrete floor in the basement that had not been there previously.
Was it paint?
So David Leake,
it wasn't paint,
went down and noticed that a can of paint was missing. His wife also noticed that a box of detergent and a bottle of pneumonia were also missing. His nephew's name, John Norman Collins.
Plot thickens. Wow.
So the pieces started to add up for Corporal Leake. And after learning that
that's why he's a corporal.
After learning that his nephew was beginning to be the prime suspect in a series of unsolved murders. Ready?
Mm.
He started to investigate a bit on his own. Leake had found out that Collins had agreed to take a lie detector test only to back out. So he knew there was more to this. So of course, he starts diving in. So Leake, this is where you're going to see it all going to come together now. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the wind up for the pitch and going to hit a home run.
Going to go.
So Corporal Leake immediately goes home. And he goes to that basement, okay? He starts scraping up some of the paint, and he finds a stain underneath that looks like blood.
Blood. I knew it.
Immediately, he called in some lab analyst. The stain turned out to be...
blood.
Varnish.
What?
However, just wait. So, suspiciously...
Did he have a shop class or something? What's going on?
Shutters. He had varnished some shutters earlier.
Oh.
So, suspiciously, Collins, when all this was taking place, calls his uncle to see if they'd found anything, if anything was going on with the case.
Oh, of course.
When
That's
Leake,
not suspicious at all.
Thank you. When Leake informed...
Hi, I'm a prime suspect of these murders, and I was just wondering, Uncle Corporal? Yeah.
So Leake informed him that it was varnish and all that. Collins began to cry. Why would you cry? Like, what?
Somebody's having a bad day.
But something else interesting happened here. When they were scraping up that paint, Jen, it seems that Corporal Leake had to relocate a washer in the basement. He had to move it so he could get underneath there.
Right.
Underneath it, he discovered tufts of hair belonging to his sons. You see, his wife would take the boys down in the basement and trim their hair. Back then, you know, moms always cut the hair.
Right.
So David Leake turned in the samples to detectives.
I seem to recall
And a new report confirmed the clippings were identical to the hair recovered in the panties left of Karen Benneman.
Wow.
So in Collins' apparent, you know, haste, and he needed to make sure there were no bloodstains down there, and he cleaned it all up. He messed up and ended up getting hair in the panties. Now the police knew exactly who the Michigan co-ed killer was, John Norman Collins.
Bastard.
Let's find out about John, shall we?
Yeah, let's do.
John Norman Collins was a 22-year-old student at Eastern Michigan University.
Go Eagles!
Majoring in education... when he was arrested for the murder of Karen Sue Beineman.
He'd be a great educator.
Great. Little kids, too, elementary.
Oh, yeah.
He was from Centerline, a suburb north of Detroit. At 6 feet tall, he was kind of wiry and muscular, with the neatly trimmed dark brown hair and sideburns. Many thought he was handsome, easy to talk to. Now, he was clean cut, not sporting that hippie look that was so popular back then. So, of course, the older
Dirty
people.
Dirty hippies.
Yeah. So, Collins worked on campus and shared a house near the campus with another roommate, a guy. He had belonged to a fraternity, but he had been kicked out under suspicion of theft.
Oh, thiefing is the least of his problems.
He also got involved in grand theft when he wrote a bad check for a camper trailer to take to California in June of 1969. He never returned the trailer, and the name on the check he wrote was lifted from a student whose wallet and ID had been stolen the week before.
Wow.
Now, we're going to get into this because there's something else that pops up with this little trip that he took to California in June of 69. Colin's home life was not very stable. His father left the family soon after his birth in Windsor, Ontario, on June 17th, 1947. His mother's second marriage lasted only a year, and her third husband was an abusive alcoholic, so she divorced him when Collins was only nine, although Collins did take his last name out of the three. In high school at St. Clement's in Centerline, he was an honor student and an athlete, lettering in three sports. He dated regularly and was president of... And he was a star pitcher for the baseball team and a tri-captain for the football team.
He tried to be a captain.
Those who knew him called him polite, quiet, respectful, and nice. However, you know, there's always one in the bunch. One former girlfriend said he seemed to be mad most of the time.
Huh. Which well, everybody thought Gacy was a nice neighbor.
He began attending Eastern Michigan.
Go Eagles.
In 1966, a year after attending Central Michigan, because he wanted to major in education and he wanted to teach the upper elementary grades. He should have graduated in 1969, but was 24 credits short.
Huh.
And he made no attempt to hurry up and get them done. No hurry to get out of college because...
He's a Toys R Us kid. I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid.
So there was still no clear motive for all these killings, but a former girlfriend may have given us a clue.
Right.
She remembered a time when Collins had walked her across campus and he began to fondle her. Suddenly, he held her away and angrily asked if she was having her period.
Oh.
She admitted she was, and he yelled at her, "That is really disgusting," and then he stormed off.
Wow.
Now, incidentally, many of the women that were murdered were also menstruating at the time of their death. So could this be the reason that maybe he would kill these women because he was angry?
They were menstruating?
Maybe because he thought they couldn't have sex? I don't know. It's just a thought. So a girl who said she had met a man who looked like Collins when he accosted her from his car remembered him saying that he couldn't stand girls with pierced ears because, quote, they left holes that defiled the body, end quote. He also told a tale of having strangled a cat with the length of clothesline. And to make this point, he put the hands around another girl's, the girl's neck to show her. Collins also expressed some ideologies that bordered on, oh, you know, psychopathy. You think?
You think?
He had told a girl that if a man had to kill, he killed. If he decided it was right for him to do it, then he had to do it. The perfect crime, he told her, was when there was no guilt. Without guilt, a person could not get caught. Collins apparently believed he could get away with murder. If, in fact, he killed all of the victims or only one, each exhibited a degree of overkill that indicated how angry he was with women. Maybe it was the pierced ears, maybe it was menstruating women, maybe it was some other weird hang-up that he had, but his rage was obvious. It was evident. He was out of control, right?
I wonder how we would pick menstruating women. Was it just a fluke?
Maybe. Although his car had been thoroughly cleaned, because remember the campus policeman, blood matching Kalam's type was found near the front seat. A red and white piece of cotton fabric was also pulled out. And that was found to match the belt around the throat of a 17-year-old female murdered in June in California.
Wow.
Bum, bum, bum. So authorities now had what they needed to make a case against John Norman Collins. Collins' trial began on June 30th, 1970, before Judge John Conlon. Witness selection took nearly 2 weeks. The prosecutor, William F. Delhi, focused only on the murder of Karen Sue Beinerman, for which there was the most physical evidence. The defense lawyer was John Lewisell from nearby Detroit. So Collins' mother originally had hired a lawyer named Richard Ryan, but Ryan had begun having doubts about his client and asked for an off-the-record polygraph test. Now, I think that's kind of interesting, like as an attorney, because I guess if you're feeling, you know, he wanted to prove to himself, he wanted to see if his client was
innocent or not.
Yeah.
But if, I guess if he was a criminal defense lawyer, that
he had some morality, I guess. He had some morals. Collins agreed to take it, and Ryan refused to disclose what it revealed. However, a good indication was that he was not pleased by it, and he suggested a change in the defense team.
Right.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Collins' mother was outraged and fired him on the spot, replacing him with the more expensive Joseph Lewisell with his partner, Neil Fink.
More expensive ones?
More expensive. Yeah.
His mother, even though she was outraged, knew that he needed
better. Well, there's a little part on here that's kind of sad, and I would really like to be a fly on the wall. Hold on.
Okay.
So Fink outlined the prosecution's strategy as this, establishing that the accused had been cruising on the afternoon of July 23rd and that he had been positively identified by witnesses as riding off with Benjamin between 12:30 and 1 o'clock, that her time of death established at no later than 3 o'clock that afternoon, and that trace evidence had confirmed Benjamin's presence in the basement of the Leak home, to which only the accused had access because the whole family was out of town. The defense strategy was to attempt to get evidence and testimony thrown out and to establish an alibi for Collins for that afternoon.
Right.
So he's only being tried on one murder.
Right. Well, that's the only one that they had evidence of.
On July 20th, testimony began. There was little rebuttal of Collins out cruising that day. Between 11:30 and 12:30, seven young women had been approached by him on his motorcycle. Time of death was also resistance to challenge.
Wow.
Key witnesses were the wig shop owner, an employee from the chocolate house, and the office supply girl. All had identified Collins as the man who had picked up Beineman the day she disappeared. Arnold Davis also testified about the box. Now, that was his roommate, remember? Mm-hmm. That he had seen Collins removing from his room.
And what's in the box?
And that Collins had pressured him to give him an alibi that he knew to be false. A former girlfriend spoke about the motorcycles that Collins owned. The defense challenged several witnesses on eyesight and memory, but failed to make a dent in their respective testimonies. The one problem the prosecution faced was evidence of police harassment and manipulation of witnesses. Still, they proved credible. In all, 57 witnesses were called for 17 days of testimony.
Wow, that's a long. Could you imagine?
No. It was the physical evidence that ultimately nailed him. Blood had matched the type A blood found in Leak's basement to the same type blood taken from Karen. Mm-hmm. None of the defense's alibi witnesses were able to offer a definitive time frame for Collins' whereabouts on that afternoon of July 23rd. However, their own fiber expert insisted that hair analysis on such minute samples could not be done with any degree of certainty. You got to remember the time back then. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if the hair in the victim's panties was from the basement floor, why was there no other debris mixed in? To top it off, this expert had collected hair shaved from the thighs of his female assistants and found that they matched. I know, right?
What?
He found that that hair matched the same from the panties. He was trying to prove that it wasn't conclusive. That the
Can you imagine how that would go over today? No. Your boss came to you and said, hey, I need you to shave your upper thighs and give me the hair.
Nope. I know, right? Different time, man. Different
and the
time.
Fact that they actually did it was another thing. Oh, my word.
The prosecution's rebuttal proved that there was indeed debris from the basement on the panties. Additional debris, right?
Right.
And that the defense's witness had used a different processing method, which yielded an inaccurate reading. Okay?
Yeah.
Always got to cross it off, right? What Delhi really wanted, however, was to get Collins on the stand and reveal what was beneath his sweet little choir boy face. Okay. Mm-hmm. It came out a girl he had tried to seduce at the Leak's home the weekend before the Benjamin murder.
Mm-hmm.
She came forward. They wanted to illustrate how he had some sexual hangups, some weird philosophies, you know, such as being able to kill if a man wants to kill. And they also wanted to talk about his years of being a thief, his history of being a thief.
Being a thief doesn't make you a murderer, but...
No, it sure does not. The defense team was uncertain about letting Collins testify, although Fink wanted to risk it. He felt that the jury would wonder why Collins was not willing to proclaim his innocence and that could go against him. Collins was willing to do it, but proved that he could not stand up to Fink's prosecutorial role-playing. He burst into anger and it alarmed the attorneys. They decided to ask the judge to allow Collins to confer with his mother in private, and she would decide whether he could take the stand in his own defense, okay?
Why wouldn't he be able to take the stand?
He kept getting mad.
So they didn't want to put him up there to show...
Yeah. Okay, but here's the sad part. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
So Collins and his mother were together in the judge's chambers for nearly a half an hour. When the door opened, Loretta Collins came out, her face puffy from crying. She made her way to the corridor wearing a shocked expression. She told the lawyers that she had learned something that she had not expected. Collins followed her out. When the judge asked if the defense had any more witnesses, they said no. both sides rusted. What do you think she found out in there? You think he confessed?
He might have.
That's crazy, huh?
Or I don't know.
I want to be a fly on the wall in there, for sure.
Would be amazing.
On August 19th, 1970, after deliberating for 3 days, the jury brought in a unanimous verdict of guilty of first-degree murder. At the sentencing hearing, Collins denied ever knowing Karen Sue Biedemann and claimed that he was innocent of her murder. He was subsequently sentenced to life imprisonment at Southern Michigan State Prison. A minimum of 20 years had to be served. Thank God he's still there.
I wonder, going back to the mom, I wonder if the mom like really harassed him, like with his problem with women might have stemmed with her being like domineering.
I couldn't find anything like that.
Or something.
Yeah, and then, just like Ed Kemper.
Right. And then like she totally railed on him until he can...
Yeah. So Collins went through 3 appeals and even changed his name to Chapman. He also tried to get a transfer to Canada, where he thought he would be eligible for parole in 1995. He also tried to escape by tunneling out of the prison.
A la Shawshank?
Like, where do they think they're going to go? The murders of the other 6 girls remain officially unsolved.
Mm-hmm.
As is sometimes the case, there's always a little bit more to the story. A search of Collins' room failed to turn up any further evidence except for what Arnold Davis was able to tell them about that box, right? Remember the box?
Mm-hmm. What's in the box?
Arnold Davis also revealed that Collins was a thief who ran his 4 motorcycles off stolen parts, and one of the bikes had recently been stolen. He had been committing these burglaries with a former roommate named Andrew Manuel. Now, here's where this is interesting, going back to the California. Andrew Manuel had just gone with Collins to California at the end of June, and it was soon learned that a 17-year-old girl named Roxy Ann Phillips had vanished in Salinas, California, right where he rented that camper trailer.
Rented? He stole.
Stole. I'm sorry. Well, he bought and then never paid for it.
Right.
A friend of hers said that she walked away from her and her house, and that Roxy went and met a man that was cruising around, and his name was John, and he was from Michigan. Phillips' strangled and battered body was discovered July 13th in a ravine near Carmel. Manuel, who had left Ypsilanti when Collins was being questioned. He was found in Arizona, but he denied knowing anything about the murder. He was charged with theft, Manuel was. During the trial, he was not pressed much about his background, which was probably due to the defense wishing to downplay that Collins even knew him or was associated with him, because they didn't want that other murder to come up on there. The state of California declined to extradite him for trial for the murder of Roxy Phillips, feeling that by 1972, that the case did not warrant priority attention. Do you believe that? Although they had delivered a grand jury indictment against him at the time of the investigation. Isn't that crazy? I guess they just feel it's a waste of money, maybe.
Yeah, but Roxy's parents needed that justice.
So if
I mean,
you remember,
I get it, but still, that's awful.
So if you remember earlier, there was the third victim, and her name was Jane Mixer, and she was murdered in a different way.
Right.
She wasn't strangled. She was shot.
Right.
Okay, so let's venture back to that.
Okay.
Go back. So here comes, what? DNA! Yay, DNA! DNA!
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
DNA all the way. DNA all the way.
2005. 62-year-old Gary Lederman, a former nurse, was tried and convicted of the killing of Jane Mixer, which was the third.
Huh.
Now, there's some... Lots of, this could be a whole nother case, let me tell you, because there was so much to this, but I just tried to trim it down.
Maybe you can do a follow-up.
It's crazy. Lederman came to the attention of authorities 35 years later because a lab report showed his DNA was found on the pantyhose of Jane Mixer. Now, he worked as a pharmaceutical salesman at the time and lived about 20 miles from the University of Michigan.
Go Eagles.
At the time of this murder. According to the Michigan State Police Lab, his DNA hadn't come from blood or semen, but had come from sweat, saliva, or skin cells.
Oh.
But here's where it's tricky. Now, remember DNA. It's still 2005. Still kind of new.
Yeah.
Some people felt that this DNA evidence was compromised because a report also said that the DNA from the spot that was scraped from her hand, from Jane Mixer's hand in 1969, also matched that of convicted killer John Rules, who was only 4 years old at the time.
Huh?
Because this was 35 years later. So,
right.
So now this other killer, John Rules, his DNA was in the CODA system and all that. So it was compromised.
Up.
There you go. So the prosecution offered no explanation as to how Rules could have been at the murder scene since he was only, four and living 40 miles away. The mixer and roulette cases had been in the lab at the same time, and many wondered if there hadn't been transference.
There had to have been.
Right?
Right.
I mean, he was 40.
There's no way.
Right. So other testimony at the trial included a handwriting comparison of two words that were written on a cover of, stay with me, on a cover of a phone book found in the basement of Michigan's law dormitory. So Jane was studying to be an attorney at that
right.
time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This was important for the prosecution because it was the only testimony that put Leiterman at the university and with knowledge of Mixer's identity. After Mixer's murder occurred, police had found where someone had written the victim's name, Mixer,
mm-hmm.
and her hometown, Muskegon, on the cover of a phone book found in the basement of the University of Michigan's law dormitory. Lieutenant Thomas Riley testified, quote, "It's my opinion that it is highly probable Gary Earl Leiterman wrote the Muskegon and Mixer entries on the phone book. However, under cross-examination, Riley admitted that he was only able to examine the photos of the book and couldn't perform the standard microscopic test because the actual book had been thrown out in 1975.
Right.
Riley further acknowledged that he had marked possible similarities in the handwriting of a diary he thought was written by Leiterman, but ultimately turned out to be written by his wife. Other testimony involved Leiterman's roommate at the time who testified that he was an avid hunter and had owned a .22 caliber handgun mm-hmm. along with other guns. And remember, the .22 caliber was the murder weapon used in Jane Mixer's death.
Right. That makes sense to me.
So, that's all I got for you.
Wow.
Is that a long, convoluted case or what?
So, it looks like Collins only technically six murders, right?
Seven. Well, he was six unsolved. But
Mixer,
it is thought that he did more.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
They thought that there's more to his...
Yeah.
Wow. Yes. Is he still alive today?
He is still alive.
Is he in Canada?
He is not in Canada. He is in Northern Michigan in prison.
Still.
Where he needs to stay forever
yes,
and ever.
Yes, forever and ever.
Yep.
Wow, I've never heard of him, Cam.
Yeah, I stumbled upon this because of Ed Kemper, and I saw Co-Ed Killer, and then I'm like, wait a minute, this is different. So then I was like, ooh, intrigued. And so, yeah. And it was I think that women are the greatest audience for true crime.
High a percentage.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, I think what always fascinates me, it's not the murder. It's like what's in their head. He was so angry at these women. Why did he do that? Why did he choose to, do certain things?
Why did he pick on women? Did the menstruation?
All of that.
Make him angry?
But it all kind of comes back to one thing, women and being mad at women. So
being mad at women that reject them
or
not having sex.
Yeah, And
that's scary, though.
It's very scary.
I mean, as a mom with two girls, it's horrifying.
And there's people out there today.
I know.
You know that.
I know.
So anyway, that's check it out. I'll put a lot of stuff on I'll try to put everything on our blog.
We're so bad at that.
That whole Leiterman thing, that's a whole... researching that, there's like a whole, he's innocent and all these people. And then, it's just, yeah.
We should do that one next. That would be interesting to figure out how...
How that happened.
His whole...
And I'm sure that, 2005, was it? That's DNA was still kind of coming on the scene a little bit.
Relatively new, right.
Not like it is today.
All wow. Right. Good case, Camille.
Thanks.
I liked it.
Thanks.
I liked it.
Hear the next one I got.
Mine's pretty good if I can ever get through writing it.
Okay.
It might be a
I can't wait.
Month-long
That's okay.
thing or a whole weekly.
We'll just change the name of the show to Jen.
Yeah.
Jen's True Crime Podcast.
I Sorry, like
Jen.
That.
Produced by Jen. Music by Jen.
Also starring Jen.
All right, take us. What do you got here? Sign us off.
I just want to say that if you guys want to get in touch with us, easiest place to do it is Twitter at our True Crime Pod is our handle. Talk to me. I want to hear you. You can also find us on Facebook. We have our own page, our True Crime Podcast. You can reach out on Gmail, our True Crime Podcast at gmail.com. We also have a blog. You can find us there too. You can also listen to our podcasts on the blog.
And YouTube.
And YouTube, yeah. Anyway, our blog is ourtruecrimepodcast.com. You can hear us on Spotify, iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, YouTube. Find us anywhere. Give us a holler. Yeah.
All right. So remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Ypsilanti. Okay. Ypsilanti?
I think so.
From Ypsilanti, Michigan. Eastern Miss.
I totally heard you.
I know.
You're sewed up there.
I'm sorry.
It was kind of cool. No, it was just kind of. We've got magical ears now.
I know. Focus, Camille. Oh, wait. Oh, this is a